Russian forces claim to have fought off insurgents in Belgorod.
The liberation is coming, that the new Russia is possible, that the armed resistance is the right way to oppose Mr. Putin.
Plus, how can Ukraine be secured once the fighting stops, and what does it mean for Russia?
That we recognize the only way we can stabilize Europe and Eurasia, ultimately, is with Russian cooperation. And so the idea of facing down Russia and having a deterrent against renewed Russian attack is part of the concept, but we have to be able to be sophisticated enough to simultaneously envision a long-term return to better relations.
And later in the program, some Ukrainian kids go to Texas for a science competition. We'll find out how they did. Today is Tuesday, May 23rd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Tension is high in southwestern Russia after attacks inside Russian territory near the Ukrainian border. Charles de Ledesma has more.
The governor of the Belgorod region on the border with Ukraine says the military and security forces continue to sweep the area around the town of Grey Voron, where the alleged attack on Monday took place. While it's not the first time Russia has alleged an incursion by Ukrainian saboteurs, it's the first time the operation to counter the incursion has continued for a second day, highlighting the struggles Moscow's facing amid its bogged-down invasion of Ukraine. Kyiv has denied the allegations, blaming Russian guerrilla groups supporting Ukraine. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Details from Belgorod are hard to come by and independent confirmation nearly impossible. Ukraine says it has nothing to do with the attacks. Russia claims to have quashed the alleged cross-border raid from Ukraine, however, and claimed to have killed more than 70 attackers in a battle that lasted about 24 hours. That's all according to a senior Moscow official. Moscow blamed the raid that began on Monday on Ukrainian military saboteurs. Kyiv portrays it as an uprising against the Kremlin by Russian partisans, even as some fighters were seen in trucks with Ukrainian markings. It's impossible to reconcile the two versions or say with any certainty who is behind the attack or what the aims were. Aya Ponomarev is an exiled Russian politician who lives in Ukraine. He says he is the political representative for the Freedom of Russia Legion, which is one of the two groups of fighters that are reportedly operating in Russian territory. He was a member of the Russian parliament from 2007 to 2016 and the only one to vote against the annexation of Crimea in 2014. He spoke with Tatiana Voroshko, managing editor of VOA's Ukrainian service.
Yeah, if you can tell us what's the latest going on with in Russia right now.
Right now, there is a special counterterrorism operation which has been done by Russian military forces. Again, the occupants of Putin, and they are liberating Russian territory. They have already liberated several villages. On the distance of currently over 40 kilometers. Obviously they met with certain resistance, but nevertheless they managed to overcome this resistance. So representatives of Russian authorities are fleeing away.
And what are you trying to achieve?
Our objective is to wave the flag of the new Russian flag, white, blue, white flag of free Russia. We intend to hold this land if it is possible. We would not risk too much lives of our soldiers, but if it would be possible, we would do our best to keep it and to show to all Russians that the liberation is coming, that the new Russia is possible, that the armed resistance is the right way to oppose Mr. Putin, and to get more volunteers to join those Russian units, because we will need them when we will be liberating Moscow.
How does local population react?
Local population is very friendly. Obviously, those which were serving Putin's government, they already fled. And we saw a lot of them. It was a whole exodus there. In general, we see very, very friendly relations. They are waiting for the outcome, obviously. They are not taking the initiative. So far, everything is good and no civilians were hurt during this counter-terrorism operation by Russian volunteer groups.
What's Ukraine's role in here, in this?
Legion, Freedom of Russia and Russian Volunteer Corps, they are part of International Legion, which reports to Ukrainian military. So obviously this operation needed to be authorized. But otherwise, there is no other involvement. There are no Ukrainian soldiers on Russian soil. They are not supervising the operation. They are not steering it in a certain way. They do not do any additional supplies or whatever. So this operation has been done by Russians on the Russian territory.
VOA Ukrainian Service Managing Editor Tatiana Voroshko speaking with exiled Russian politician Iya Ponomarev. President Volodymyr Zelensky visits troops in the east, shelling in Dnipro, and more information on the situation in Belgorod. I'm joined now by our reporter in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova.
Very interesting schedule of President Zelensky. He's just back from G7 meeting, and now he is visiting the front line in the east. Today is a Marine Corps of Ukraine Day in Ukraine, and this is one of the reasons also why he decided to go. According to his official statement, he is visiting the defense line at Vuhledar and Marienka, which is in the Donetsk region. Of course, he joined the commemorate activities and service for the fallen soldiers.
Yesterday, you told us about some Russian rebels who are causing trouble for the Russian military near the border with Ukraine. Can you fill us in on what's been happening?
Yes, the story is ongoing and the story is evolving. We are seeing that Russian officials are accusing Ukraine, saying that this is something that was prepared and organized by Ukraine. For the moment, we don't have independent confirmation of this. We cannot verify this. According to official statement by the Ukrainian officials, well, Ukraine has nothing to do with this. But of course, we understand that definitely, if not this full scale invasion, this would have not happening on the territory of Belgorod. So this is something that we should definitely keep in mind. But for the moment, there is a group of Russian soldiers who are against, as they say, Putin regime and who take responsibility for these actions officially. What we know that there is evacuation. People are evacuating themselves or Russian authorities evacuate people from the area. We know that nuclear weapon was also evacuated. This was discussed yesterday as well. So for the moment, it's really unclear what's the situation, the state in there. But the rebel group continue to confirm that they are basically liberating, as they say, more territories in that pre-border line.
Well, the Russians are claiming that they have squashed the terrorists and that they have killed over 70 of them, and the remainders have fled back into Ukraine. Has there been any comment about casualties, any comment about where they might be from Kyiv?
Not yet. We don't have any details on that or any additional detailed comments from Kyiv officials. I think that we might get something, but again, the main comment was yesterday that Ukraine has nothing to do with this from the Ukrainian officials. I mean, so we will see if Ukrainian authorities will keep on commenting on that. But for the moment, there is no new comments from the Ukrainian officials.
And Anna, one thing that we haven't been able to speak about, it was a day or two ago, terrible, intense shelling in Dnipro. Can you tell us what happened and then how things are going there now?
Yes, it was really, you're absolutely right, it was a very terrible shelling with different kind of weapons used, with missiles, with drones, and there are damages. There are damages of the civilian areas and of the industrial areas. What also people told me that, well, basically, everyone was just praying that this would end, because it was really a terrible couple of hours during the night, and it happened just in the middle of the night. So similar tactics was used as was used in Kyiv. There is information on injured as well, but luckily the number is not high.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
How to secure Ukraine after the war ends. My next guest is Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. The answer, he says, lies with a new organization, an Atlantic Asian Security Community, and oddly, not with NATO.
Well, it may be odd for some, although it happens to be essentially where the administration is. The administration doesn't want Ukraine and NATO, at least not anytime soon. And I don't hear too much criticism of that position from Republicans. In a way, I think the common sense view of a lot of folks is bringing Ukraine into NATO, doesn't that feel pretty sensitive? Doesn't that feel pretty provocative? Is that really necessary? Is that really the way to stabilize Europe when it's almost guaranteed to further antagonize Russia, even if it's not justifiable the way Russia has reacted? And I certainly don't think it is, and I'm not defending Vladimir Putin in any way, shape, or form. It is a longstanding acknowledgement of reality in many places in this country and elsewhere that Ukraine is a very important country for Russia, maybe even closer to Russia than Canada is to the United States in history and in other ways. And the idea that we're going to bring this country into a Western alliance system and then promise to deploy American boys and girls, men and women, to fight in defense of that country as if it were American soil, that seems like a bit of a stretch.
Okay, so if not NATO, how can the West and the world writ large protect Ukraine?
Well, the idea that Lise Howard and I have developed is, first of all, you need to have some physical presence in Ukraine in order to show solidarity, but also to have a tripwire that, in effect, American forces would be committed to this country and would be willing, presumably, to take some risk on its behalf. And that if American forces are inside of Ukraine and vulnerable, that the United States would likely be willing to go in and rescue them or protect them if the going got tough. So we see this idea of a training mission as sort of a more indirect way to create a deterrent than a NATO Article 5 mutual defense pledge. It's a little bit more unspoken, a little bit more implicit, but it's still a pretty firm commitment, because it's hard to believe that Vladimir Putin or a successor in the Kremlin could attack Ukraine if there are hundreds of American troops distributed throughout that country who would inevitably be drawn in to the opening phases of any fight.
American troops going in to train Ukrainian troops and then presumably protect the forces. Doesn't this sound kind of like the beginnings of Vietnam?
Well, in Vietnam, we didn't have the same kind of longstanding interest in fending off aggression. In Vietnam, we were worried about communist infiltration and revolution. And, we had helped the French in the early 50s. Then we had sort of tracked this, but we saw it in the context of a global competition with communism. And we defined Vietnam as important in that competition, not because of anything about Vietnam per se, or its location or its resource base or anything like that, but because we were so, honed in on this idea of a global communist menace. In this case, it is actually Ukraine that we care about. And so we're not sort of just viewing this as a domino or a poker chip or, one element in a broader global game of risk. We're actually dealing with a country that we've been trying to help, establish its own sovereignty, protect itself, going back to 1994 with the Budapest Memorandum. And so there's a longstanding history here where we've been focused directly on Ukraine on its own terms. Now, if your point is, aren't these kinds of indirect commitments risky because you can sort of get into an incrementalist approach where you keep upping the ante. I agree, which is why Lise Howard and I are explicit in saying this is designed to lock us into Ukraine's defense. It's not NATO, and with all the baggage that NATO has in the Russian mind, but it is similar to NATO in that we're not really proposing something that would have us be half pregnant with a security commitment. This is an actual security commitment. Again, it does have some similarities to NATO. So even though I criticized that idea in my first answer, I would acknowledge that we are trying to really make a true American commitment, not a treaty commitment per se, but a pretty explicit one nonetheless. But again, we're trying to use a mechanism that we think is less provocative towards the Russian mind and towards Vladimir Putin, because it doesn't involve the very same organization that defeated the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And it offers a possible path to Russian membership someday if Russia's politics change.
Well, that was my next question, is that one of the aspects of your plan that I think makes it unique is that it does leave room to invite Russia back into polite society, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, so that's the distinction. I mean, there are three sort of distinctions with our proposal vis-a-vis NATO membership for Ukraine, as I would sketch it out anyway. One of them is this is just not NATO. It doesn't have all the history and all the baggage, but it still comes pretty close to having the same kind of security commitment. Two is that it's done with a different group and maybe a broader group of countries that could even involve countries outside of Europe, potentially. And then three, and most explicitly, most importantly, it involves this idea of an open door towards Russian membership someday. That would obviously not be something that Russia itself would even acknowledge they care about right now, and not something that anybody wants to offer to Russia right now, but it would be a possibility. And the whole idea would be with that specifically in mind, that we are not trying to make Russia a permanent pariah, that we recognize the only way we can stabilize Europe and Eurasia ultimately is with Russian cooperation. And so the idea of facing down Russia, having a deterrent against renewed Russian attack, is part of the concept, but we have to be able to be sophisticated enough to simultaneously envision a long-term return to better relations. And I think that's an absolutely crucial piece of this, which with all of our understandable hatred and anger towards Vladimir Putin today, we have to bear in mind how you build a long-term stable relationship, not repeat the 1920s, where Germany was not only punished at the end of World War I, but the conditions were laid essentially for Germany's radicalization and even the rise of Hitler. And then, of course, the outbreak of World War II. We don't want to have Russia so far pushed away and ostracized that it runs the risk of going down a similar path.
Michael O'Hanlon is Director of Research of Foreign Policy for the Brookings Institution. He's co-author of a new paper on backstopping Ukraine's long-term security. You can read it on the Brookings Institution's webpage. Mr. O'Hanlon, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this important subject with you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. From May 14th through May 19th, four students from Ukraine were participating in this year's Regeneron International Science and Engineering Fair, or the ISEF. This year's contest was held in Dallas, Texas, with participants competing for awards of up to $75,000. VOA's Steve Miller has their story.
The Society of Science founded the International Science and Engineering Fair back in 1950 because, as CEO Maya Ajmera told me last year,
STEM is absolutely important for every young person to have the opportunity to become a scientist or engineer, if that's what they want to be when they grow up. And so the Society for Science is really making sure that young people have those opportunities.
The 2023 Regeneron International Science and Engineering Fair has over 1,600 9th through 12th graders from around the world competing for prizes ranging from $500 to $75,000, totaling in all to nearly $9 million. This year, four Ukrainian students are participating. Ilya, whose project focused on finding ways to use kinetic energy generated by waterfalls to provide power to people living in remote areas. Also from Ukraine, Irina and Valeria, who are researching stem cells. And rounding out the Ukrainian contingent is Dennis, with a project using augmented reality to provide people with extra navigational aids. Now, I spoke to all the students over Zoom, and Dennis told me that it took a while for this year's students to make the trip to Dallas.
The trip was really long. The actual flight takes only 13 hours, but before the flight, we have a really fun adventure.
Yeah.
So, firstly, we should go to the Poland because there is no flights from the Ukraine. And in the Poland, we have the visa application, and the interview for this application was the day before the flight.
Yeah.
That's Irina.
But unfortunately, embassy didn't see our payment, and they can't take us to the interview. And so they said, like, the next day, please come. And in this day, we have a flight, and we go to go and, like, try to change the flight date and go to the embassy. And they say, finally, yes, we take a visa to you, and we go. But in this day, immediately after it, we try to buy tickets from the new one.
Yeah, so we miss the first flight, yeah. And we need to...
And making the trip all the way to Dallas also provided the students with an important opportunity, says Irina.
So it's really amazing because we did it and we're here, and it's feeling that you see every human that the same like you, women that understand you, that can help to you. It's amazing feeling because seriously, when you start speaking with them, understand that you're not only like this one, it's the whole world, because a lot of people can't understand you, what you think about it.
Now that the competition is done, Ilya outlined what's next. Now, he doesn't speak English all that well, so Dennis provided an interpretation.
Якщо в нього невеликі водоспади середнього розміру, можна створити, і вже вони є створені великі
водоспади, можна... Ilya is going to continue the work on this project, and actually the project is almost ready to be applied on middle-sized waterfalls. Not the big one, but he actually needs money to make the prototypes.
This year's contest comes at a time of intensified Russian attacks across Ukraine, including in the capital city of Kyiv, where Valeria's family is from. She shared with me what it's like being half a world away as news of continued bombardment emerged from her home country. Dennis again interpreted.
Сложно постоянно атаки і постоянно всі новості про ситуацію, яка відбувається в Україні.
Valeria is really it's difficult for her to trying to focus on the science competitions, high matter, but she thinks that in the Kyiv with her family, they actually experienced the bombing by the Russians, and yeah, it's evident that it's really difficult.
CEO Maya Ajmera previously said that a goal of the society is to create an environment where every young person can participate and foster growth in young STEM innovators, because...
You don't learn science and engineering by reading it in a book. You learn it by doing.
Steve Miller, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage of Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com, and on social media, be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.